So the fine folks over on Patreon voted for me to cover some of my favourite wacky ship designs. Now, I have covered some odd ships in the past, but I thought specifically this time around, I would cover wacky ship designs that all have a common theme, which is absurdly large armament and or comical things related to said armament. So let's kick off with this wonderful ship. Now, some of you may have seen this before, either in other videos I've done or on the internet, because, well, it is a little bit of a meme vessel, but what exactly is it? Well, this is HMS Drudge, or rather I should say this is an HMS Drudge, because as with a number of other vessels which you find in the Royal Navy, Drudge was, by and large, the name of a ship that was attached to HMS Excellent, the gunnery school, which in itself was named after one of the first ships to be used as an accommodation ship for said gunnery school. And so you can find multiple references to HMS Drudge of various descriptions. So, for example, the previous HMS Drudge was a Frolic-class gun vessel, which can lead to some confusion, because sometimes people will say this is the Frolic-class gun vessel in later life. However, the Frolic-class are actually a little bit longer. They displace slightly less, but more specifically, the Frolic-class machinery spaces, and therefore the location of the funnel, are slightly forward of dead centre, whereas on this vessel, as you can see, well, that funnel is very clearly all the way nicely at the back. And ultimately, she is a descendant of a number of other what are termed Rendall flat-iron gunboats, which were developed by the Royal Navy in the 1870s and the 1880s, with a couple of major classes built. These are technically the successors of the mass-produced gunboats that were made in the Crimean War, primarily for shore bombardment, and in some ways you can see them as the successor of the bomb ship or mortar vessel of the Age of Sail, or perhaps the predecessor of the monitors of World War I and World War II. But one thing that most of them share is one absurdly large gun for their displacement. Although perhaps the ultimate example of this, Drudge is not actually one of those specifically. In 1887, when she was launched, she actually had a very different purpose, and at that point she wasn't even HMS anything. So to cite the newspaper clipping from the day after she was launched, it says, launch of a novel vessel at Walker. Yesterday afternoon, there was launch from the Low Walker Shipbuilding Yard of Messrs. Sir W.G. Armstrong Mitchell and Company, a vessel of a novel description and named the Drudge. The vessel in question is a screw steamer of 400 tons burthen and is intended for the firm's own use as a hopper barge in carrying waste material to sea from Elswick. But, combined with this, she is so arranged that guns of 110 tons, or even heavier, can be mounted and taken out to sea for testing, or, if required, to be used in warfare. And this was basically building on the experience of the Royal Navy's flat-iron gunboats, and as it suggests, initially her service was somewhat for waste disposal, but since Armstrong, later Vickers Armstrong, was one of those rather useful companies that could make both the armament and the ship to go with it, as the clipping suggests, it was set up as essentially a test vessel, which actually made an awful lot of sense, because if you're talking about guns of that period, as it says, guns of 110 tons or more, that is quite a weight to be go carting around, especially in the 1880s and 1890s, when, of course, you don't have big trucks and so forth. So taking such heavy guns out to a fixed test range on land could be quite difficult, whereas if you could manufacture them either close to the sea or somewhere that had a direct rail connection to the sea, which Armstrong's obviously did, then you could simply take the gun, crane it aboard this vessel, and once it was fitted, you could take it out and test the gun in the wide open expanses of the sea, where you didn't have to worry about anyone or anything. And of course, you could then, if you wanted to, take the gun off again in the same manner that you would fit out or refit a ship. So all the craneage and everything was already in place for that. And as you can see here, she tested a wide variety of guns at various points, including 13.5-inch guns used for the Royal Sovereign-class battleships, but some of her most famous photos, including these, are from when she was carrying a 9.2-inch mounting, which, given that it says it's 400-ton burthen, just under 900 tons displacement. So this is well under 1,000 tons, and she's carrying a gun that is roughly equivalent to either small battleships or some of the larger armoured cruisers. And those ships outmass her by a factor of 10 to 15. Granted, it is only one gun, and you might think, oh, but she was a test ship. But remember what it says in that newspaper clipping: or if required, to be used in warfare. So as well as being used theoretically for shore bombardment, one of the other ideas of these gunboats, albeit potentially a somewhat less successful idea, depending on who you ask, was as a kind of mobile shore fortification. Because, of course, one of the big problems of shore fortifications is that they don't move. So you can build a really complex, heavily armed fort in one place, but if you have a lot of coastline and a lot of coastal cities and the enemy goes to another place that you haven't fortified, all the fortifications at the first place were pretty useless. And if you build and fortify heavy gun emplacements everywhere the enemy might attack, it's going to cost you an absolute fortune. So to kind of square that circle, a secondary use of these various flat iron gunboats was essentially, they're not going to win any prizes for taking on oceanic ships at sea, but in confined coastal waters, like, say, when someone's coming in to do shore bombardment, well, if you have a small fleet of these scattered up and down the coast, then when you think, the enemy is coming for this location, then a whole battery of heavy guns can very quickly move to that location. And being flat iron gunboats, as the name suggests, having essentially a flat underside, they can go into very, very shallow water, which gives them an advantage in terms of surprise attacks and so forth. But it also means that if, rather understandably, they get hit by incoming fire and sunk, they can position themselves in such a way over a sandbank or such like that they're only going to sink a few inches, maybe a foot or two, at which point you can't sink them anymore, and they are still firing heavy caliber shells at you, potentially from very, very close ranges. I also rather like this photo, which looks like it's got a bayonet fitting on the gun. And now for another ship, which I've mentioned several times in various videos, the Matsushima-class cruisers. This is not, in fact, a slightly converted ocean liner, nor, believe it or not, is it an attempt to go back to the classic Nelsonian age of sail with just pure gun decks. This is, in fact, a cruiser that does have a main gun. It's just in this particular picture, it's somewhat hidden by the big awning at the back. And yes, you did hear me right. The main gun is at the back. This isn't the case for the entire class, but this is the Voltron class, as I like to call it. And for a very long time, this was the largest class of warship built in Japanese yards. While they upgraded their yards, they ordered all subsequent armored cruisers and battleships in the pre-dreadnought era from foreign yards, which only ended in the Russo-Japanese war period. So what was the general idea behind this? Well, part of the problem was the Japanese couldn't build battleships of their own in their own yards. And so they had this idea of building a class that in peacetime could be multiple cruisers and therefore serve multiple cruiser functions, you know, showing the flag, patrolling, etc., etc. In theory, could at least hold their own, given that they were protected cruisers, against other protected cruisers, because they do have quite an extensive secondary battery, as you can probably tell. But in the event of a battle, despite not having any belt armor at all, the idea was to Voltron themselves into an effective pre-dreadnought. And you might be thinking, how exactly? Well, if we take a look at one of the sister ships, in this case, Ikitsushima, or Itsukushima, I think, actually, you'll see on this vessel, it looks the other way around. The gun is at the front. And that's because the idea was to build four such vessels, two with the guns at the front, two with the guns at the rear, and then in battle, in a fleet battle that is, you would have the two ships with the guns mounted forward, that being Itsukushima and Hashidate, in front, and then you might have Matsushima and the fourth vessel proceeding behind, so they would have their guns pointing backwards, and between them, that gave them four, in this case 12.6-inch guns, but essentially four pre-dreadnought main caliber guns, and they would then fire on the enemy. And the added advantage was if you did manage to sink one of them, well, the other three would still be perfectly fine, and they'd actually be bringing, as long as they were all afloat, four ships worth of secondary batteries, which is actually quite scary when you consider that the secondary battery is around a dozen 4.7-inch guns, which means there's actually 48 4.7-inch guns between the four of them, which means a 24 secondary battery gun broadside, which in the era of the hail of fire could actually be quite dangerous, plus torpedo tubes, of course. But there were a number of problems with this. Firstly, they didn't actually build Matsushima's sister ship, so you ended up with two ships with the forward guns and one ship with the aft gun, so you only had three quarters of a pre-dreadnought. Secondly, of course, you've got, even if you had built all four sets of fire control solutions, so there's no guarantee if you fired a joint salvo that those four shells are going to go anywhere close to where you actually want them to go. You also have, in theory, again, we're all assuming for the sake of argument that they did build all four, although obviously you just insert three if you want for the realistic scenario. You've got multiple sets of maintenance, ships coming in and out of maintenance, crews, you know, three, maybe four captains if you'd built all four. And ultimately, these are small protected cruisers, although ironically, if you add up their total displacement, if you were going to build all four, that actually does add up roughly to the displacement of a large pre-dreadnought battleship, and the three together add up to the displacement of a small pre-dreadnought battleship. But the two biggest issues are, one, being a protected cruiser, they would be relatively easy to rip apart with, ironically enough, either primary or secondary battery fire, so they could be made combat ineffective pretty darn quickly. The other thing was, that 12.6-inch gun, not really designed for use on a ship that displaces only a little bit over 4,000 tons, and so they had huge amounts of issues in terms of reloading the thing and using it generally, because, well, it put a lot of strain on the ship whenever it fired. Now, to be fair, the Matsushima class did actually see combat, although I think fortunately for them it was against the Chinese fleet in the first Sino-Japanese War, or should I say the first modern edition of the ongoing Sino-Japanese War. And they did fairly well there, although, to be honest, a guy with a rowboat and a slingshot could have done fairly well against the Beiyang fleet. And they were around, believe it or not, for the Russo-Japanese War, although they tended to hang around in the background, which I think was just as well for everybody involved. But yeah, the idea of the Voltron pre-dreadnought wasn't really particularly successful, and they remain, I think fortunately for all concerned, the only ships to actually try it. The next entry is a little bit of a two-for-one, because, again, this is a ship you may have already heard of, HMS Swift. Now, HMS Swift was a very large for World War I destroyer. She was, in fact, a destroyer leader, but even so, we're talking about a period when she's laid down in the mid-1900s, when destroyers are averaging 500 to 600 tons at the upper end, and, she's 1,800. So a little over three times the displacement of the average destroyer, which, if you look at, let's say, the interwar period, when most destroyers are averaging around 1,500 tons, or maybe a little bit more, that's the equivalent not of building a 2,500-3,000 tonner like the French or the Germans or some of the Japanese. That's equivalent of building a 4,500-ton destroyer, which would actually be even bigger and heavier than even a Capitani Romani class, which a lot of people would consider to be a small light cruiser. Nonetheless, Swift was not the world's greatest success. She was fast, that much is true. Mind you, she ate coal like nobody's business, because, of course, being a mid-1900 ship, she was coal-powered. So you can imagine when trying to get this thing moving through the water at the mid-30s of knots, being a stoker aboard this vessel was not a fun place to be. She was also, in theory, supposed to do the high end of 30s of knots, but only ever managed to, low to mid-30s, which was a bit of a disappointment. I mean, it still made her faster than pretty much any other destroyer at the time. But, you had a destroyer that was three times the displacement of all others, was an absolute pig to get up to that kind of speed, and was only armed with four-inch guns, which, while okay, appreciable for the mid-1900s, still wasn't massive. But in the middle of World War One, there were a variety of Royal Navy destroyers out there that were armed with the 12-pounder gun, which is better known to us these days as effectively a 3-inch. And some destroyers had 4-inch guns, but they tend to be relatively short barrel, low velocity 4-inch. Some of the latest Royal Navy destroyers were armed with better 4-inch guns, but a number of the older destroyers, when they met German destroyers, at least when they met some of the newer German destroyers, they reported that they had a bit of a problem in that the newest German destroyers carried 105mm guns that had a fairly considerable range. So if it was a newer German ship versus an older British ship, the German ship could outrange and in many cases actually also outshoot in terms of rate of fire the older British destroyers. And since most of the most modern British destroyers were up with the Grand Fleet, well, that didn't bode well for conflicts in the Channel. And so the Royal Navy decided, okay, let's, as is tradition, go one step above immediately. And so they grabbed a 6-inch gun, yes, a light cruiser gun, and decided, well, what if we stuck this thing on the front of the Swift instead? Because, well, it's a big ship, it should be able to take it, and a 6-inch gun carries a lot more firepower and a lot more range than a 105mm gun. So they did this, and, shockingly enough, even as large as she was, Swift was not a particularly good platform for this weapon. Maneuvering the shells and then loading, aiming and firing the thing on a very lively, high-speed ship that was constantly moving and bouncing its way through the water, which Swift obviously was, that's not really a viable way of doing things. Even two decades down the line with ships like the Mogadors, the French would find that operating at very high speed also made the guns almost unmanageable. But it gets better than that, because Swift wasn't the only one to have this treatment. Sharing this treatment, or should we say perhaps a victimization, was a ship about half a displacement. Poor old HMS Viking, one of the first tribal class destroyers, as in a member of the World War One tribal class. And she's under 1,000 tons. And whereas Swift at least went into action originally with 4 4-inch guns, poor old Viking here only had 2 4-inch guns, and she was suddenly expected to replace her forward 4-inch gun with a 6-inch gun. And shockingly enough, that didn't work either. So, the idea of mounting one very big gun on a relatively small ship, shockingly, it didn't work out that well. Although, given the previous iteration, you might think, again. Next up, in terms of ships with absurdly large guns strapped to them, two of the Lord Clive class monitors. Now, this comes from a slightly convoluted set of circumstances. Initially, of course, there was HMS Furious, a much larger ship with 2 single 18-inch guns, one at each end, plus a third gun as a spare. Then they decided this was a silly idea, and Furious became a semi-carrier with a flight deck at the front and 1 18-inch gun aft, but that meant that in the immediate term there were 2 18-inch guns spare. So, of course, what do? They decided they were going to use them to shoot at the Germans anyway. At first, the idea was actually to take them on land, or take them to land in France, and install them there where they could be used to shell German ports captured that were in German hands. But it turns out the Allied armies weren't advancing far enough to the east in order for them to use the buildings which would be needed to mount the guns in. And so they decided instead, well, why don't we stick them on some monitors? Why on monitors? Well, there'd actually been a bit of an arms race going on between the monitors, and in this case the Lord Clive class had 12-inch guns taken from old pre-dreadnoughts, and the German coastal defences, which had been getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And of course, one of the advantages of land-based coastal guns is you can massively increase their elevation a lot more easily than you can with ships. So although the 12-inch arm monitors had been quite dangerous initially, they were now outranged. So the solution was, well, if you think you can outrange me, I'm just going to put a bigger gun on and outrange you. And so both the Lord Clive and the General Wolfe had 18-inch guns installed on them. Except that the sensible thing to do, you would think, would be to replace the twin 12-inch turret with a single 18. No, that's far too normal. We're going to leave that in place. We're just going to stick it on the back. Except, the monitors aren't really designed to support a gun like this. And if you're not replacing the existing turret and barbette mechanism, loading could be a problem because you'd have to build the entire barbette and loading mechanism into a relatively shallow draft hull. And so instead, the guns were mounted sideways, pointing to starboard. Now, it is a little bit of a common misconception that these guns are completely fixed and welded to the deck. They did actually have some ability to train. Not much. There's only about 20 degrees of play in it, but it at least meant you weren't having to align the entire ship on a broadside target. You just had to mostly align the ship on a broadside target and then do the final refinement into your aiming with the traverse. What they could do, however, unlike the 12-inch guns, was elevate quite high. And in fact, because of the amount of blast they produced, there was a minimum elevation of about 22 degrees below which you would start to do serious damage to the ship, both in terms of the blast and in terms of the forces that the mounting would be exerting horizontally. Now, this in and of itself might seem somewhat absurdly silly, and indeed it pretty much was, unless you happen to be on the receiving end of the bombardment. However, my favourite little bit of lore about this, which again is something I have mentioned in the past, is these things have their own little railway system. Because the shells were passed up from below through a little hatch just behind the turret or shield, if you like, but the charges were stored in little containers on deck, which, yes, it sounds absurdly dangerous, but to be honest, storing them out on deck is about the only place they won't explode if they get hit. Yes, they are more likely to be set on fire because, well, they're exposed, but it's not like a monitor has particularly great armour anyway. But if they're out in the open, they're more likely to just burn off. I mean, it won't be nice being near them, but at least you won't explode. But in any case, these charges were still quite difficult to manhandle, and so they installed this little neat light railway system, which not only isn't just a loop, it's actually quite a nice little L shape. It even has its own switching and sliding. It's so cute. And since the Lord Clive class is, or was, I should say, about 335 feet long, that technically means that you could model a Lord Clive class monitor in 1 to 76 scale, which is the scale of 00 railways in the UK. You could do it 1 to 87 scale, which is HO if you're elsewhere in the world. But that would mean that you could make a model of a Lord Clive class monitor that's about 4 feet long, a little bit over a metre. And then if you modelled the miniature railway, you probably using N scale or something like that, you could legitimately have a working model railway that is also a model ship. And then finally, you've got another little two for one. Now, people very often, rightfully, point out that the Courageous class and the associated half-sister Furious in their original forms were questionable design choices at best. However, the idea of a small, absurdly fast, absurdly heavily armed, but incredibly lightly built ship was not unique to Jackie Fisher. And in fact, there were people who actually went a little bit further down that particular rabbit hole than he did. Enter, of course. Any guesses? It's the US Navy. I bet you didn't see that one coming, because, yeah, in certain corners of the internet, you'll find people going, the US Navy never wanted battlecruisers. They never thought about battlecruisers until the Lexingtons. Yeah, they did, actually. I'll point out various dry docks. There's actually a very long design lineage of US battlecruisers. They were just never built because Congress wouldn't fund them. But nonetheless, let's quickly remind ourselves. The Courageous class have two twin 15-inch turrets and a maximum of 3-inch belt armor, looking for a speed of about 32 knots on a little bit over 19,000 tons. So I'm going to introduce you to two different designs from the US Navy dated to 1915. Now, admittedly, there were some other ships which were a little bit more in the order of the Courageous class. And yeah, if that doesn't scare you. However, here are two of the ones that were a little bit more, shall we say, out there in terms of design. And there are a few adjacent as well, so I don't think these are two unique things. Anyway, here is design 121. This is a 12,650-ton ship, so we're talking about something that displaces somewhat on the order of a small to medium-sized pre-dreadnought, and, well, about 7,000-ish, a bit more than 7,000 tons less than the Courageous class. It is supposed to have a top speed of 35 knots, the magical speed that the US looked for in what is theoretically here a scout cruiser. So somewhat faster than the Courageous class. And it has a rather interesting armament. As you can see, there is a single twin 14-inch turret up front, then several pairs of 5-inch guns heading aft, finally finishing off with a single 5-inch gun. So yeah, this thing is just cruising around very happily with just its single forward pair of 14-inch guns at a fair old clip. And you'll notice when it's adding up the weight, there's about 6,000 tons for the hull, about 3,500 tons for the steam plant. There's weight allocated for the fuel, for the water, for the equipment, for the stores, for the guns. There's nothing for protection. You go over to the left-hand side. Yeah, it's a turbine-powered ship. It, for protection, it just says no protection. So, a rifle-proof turret. And this thing is even less well-protected than the Courageous class. It's just a gigantic destroyer, effectively, with an absurdly heavy front gun. As I said, there were a few designs that looked into this idea of no protection, very low displacement with two 14-inch guns, but it does get better, because then you have design number 134. Now, this is admittedly almost 1,000 tons heavier at about 13,500 tons, and they have dropped the speed to just 30 knots, so a little bit slower than the Courageous class, but we are still talking something that is 5 to 6,000 tons lighter. Except now, this really is getting into being an American Courageous class because, well, there's 4 guns in 2 twin turrets, and they're 16 inches, so this is 2 knots slower than Courageous class. About 2/3 the displacement, but actually has a heavier armament. And it's also somehow fitting in this 10 6-inch guns. It doesn't actually show where on the plans. I'm going to guess, like with the other ones, that they're supposed to be deck-mounted in between. There's not really much other justification for having the aft turret so far back. And yeah, minimal superstructure. Just the bridge, the 2 funnels, and the 2 guns and a couple of masts. And you'll be glad to know that this does have some protection, although you'll see it notes that the turrets are armoured only at the front, the sides, top and rear are only light structural plating, and, well, it's 4-inch plating, so you can maybe stop a light cruiser gun. The barbettes are also armoured. They've got 4-inch. And that's it. There is no belt armour. There is no deck armour. And, this is almost as fast as the Courageous class. Actually, just fractionally more heavily armed. And even less well protected. And given that when you get to some of these absurdly fast ships like the Courageous class, the Lexingtons, or this thing, armor tends to end up having a structural purpose because, well, otherwise they just tend to fly apart very easily. I'm not sure this thing would actually stand up to all that much. It is admittedly a little bit shorter. It's just under 700 feet as opposed to just under 800 feet on the Courageous is. But given the entire thing is just framing and hull plating. I would pay good money to see what happens to this thing when you try and run it at 30 knots, or the other slightly smaller one at 35 knots. So yeah, the madness of the ridiculously lightly protected fast gunboat on a macro scale, not a uniquely British thing, and I think actually I have to give the prize for taking it to the extremes to the Americans in this case. So there you go, some wacky ship designs, all themed around how many ridiculously large guns can we fit on an inappropriately small and lightly protected hull. And, well, I hope you've enjoyed this, and see you again in another video soon. Bye for now.
That's it for this video. Thanks for watching. If you have a comment or suggestion for a ship to review, let us know in the comments below. Don't forget to comment on the pinned post for dry dock questions.